Star jump sequence terminates, Captain.
Get the gravitational dampers online and open the blast shield.
Aye, sir.
Bring us in closer.
Aye, aye, sir. Moving us in on sublight drive.
Extreme magnification.
Aye, sir.
The center of the galaxy. And there's our black hole.
The experience of a lifetime, Captain.
Let me put this on audio. You should be able to hear the magnetic resonance.
This is it, ladies and gentlemen. The edge of time and space, where the impossible can happen. Welcome to the event horizon.
Good morning, or afternoon, or evening, whatever is relevant for the part of the world you are in. Indeed, welcome to the Event Horizon, where the impossible happens. Join us each week at this time as we delve into the worlds of science fiction, fantasy, and science fact in all their forms. I'm your host, Gene Turnbow.
And I am your other host, Susan Fox.
And with us is Mark Guggenheim, a powerhouse in the entertainment industry. You won't believe all the stuff that came out of his pen and his offices. Oh my gosh.
Things we've loved for the past 15 years, and a few that not everybody loved, but we actually liked.
Well, thank you. Thank you very, very much. That's a beautiful introduction. It makes me feel very good about myself.
Yeah, well, it should, man. I'm just stoked to have you on the show.
Thank you.
So we're here to talk about a comic book series that you have written and you're producing.
Yes.
And it's Ulysses Monarch, The Adventures of Ulysses Monarch.
The first issue is up on Amazon, Comixology for free, if you have Kindle Unlimited. I almost said Kindle United, and I know that's not right.
I think it's Kindle Unlimited, yeah. Yeah, it just came out, actually, like 2 weeks ago, I think.
Thereabouts. And I get to the end of it and I'm going, what do you mean I have to wait a month?
No, actually, I think each issue comes out, pretty much once a month. The first arc is 5 issues long. I really appreciate you checking it out.
What I noticed about it is that, I thought, okay, here, a TV producer and writer and motion picture screenwriter is now doing a graphic novel. I mean, JMS did that. Certainly moves back and forth freely in that.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, okay, well, this is going to be kind of, I don't know, animate-y or television-y.
No, it wasn't. It's not a demotion by any means, because you've made quite the name in other people's properties. And now you're striking out on your own.
But what I noted about this is it has more of a feel of heavy metal than anything.
Oh, thank you. Heavy metal
there's a pinnacle here, and you're reaching it with the quality of the art and the quality of the writing. This is just wow.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that. Yeah, Harvey Talabo and Mark Englert, our team, they're just fantastic. I mean, I'd worked with Harvey and Mark on 2 separate projects, before, and just knew that they were the exact right, people to help me visualize this crazy world. They've done a superlative job.
So you moved the project off as a comic book series instead of a TV show or a screenplay?
You know, it's funny. This originally, I wouldn't say that the idea started out as a TV show, but I started thinking about the thing that became this in response to sort of a TV prompt. So basically, there's a period of time where it seemed like all the streamers were saying, we really want something like a sci-fi Indiana Jones or an Indiana Jones. Mm-hmm. And they just kept, saying, we really want something that they call it four quadrant, something the whole family can enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
And, I got to thinking about it, and I started really thinking about, Indiana Jones and what makes Indiana Jones interesting. And to me, what makes Indiana Jones interesting is, he's, exploring all these essentially ancient civilizations or the remains of these ancient civilizations. And I just started to think, oh, what if the ancient civilization, in quotes, is ours? And the problem is that once I came up with this idea, sort of Indiana Jones in the future, I realized, oh, this is far too expensive for television. This will never fly as a TV show.
It would exceed the budget of Andor.
It would.
So many of the props are contemporary objects.
Well, a lot of them are, you know, but the sets,
the
and the ships,
the,
and the clothes, and you know, you spend as much on wardrobe as you do on the sets sometimes.
You know, I realized that this idea would far too expensive for television.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, I've been writing comic book for the last 20 years, and I, you know, this actually coincided with. It coincided with two things. Number one, it coincided with the pandemic, which gave me a lot of time to do comic book work. But also, it coincided with my New Year's resolution for 2020, which I made before I knew there would be a global pandemic, which was I really wanted to get back into creator-owned comics. I had done a bunch of creator-owned comics, but it had been a while. I think it was like 7 or 8 years since I had done one. And Harvey and I had seen each other at a comic book convention, and we were talking about doing a creator-owned book together. So really, all the planets aligned, all the, circumstances that needed to come into play, including having time to write it, all came into play starting with the pandemic. But of course, you're probably wondering, like, well, hey, that was 5 years ago. Why are we just seeing the book now? And the answer is, even with the pandemic shutdown, Harvey and I were very, very busy. This was a long process it's almost like a year per issue, really. But that happens sometimes, when you're dealing with, compromised or, challenged schedules.
Well, and it's often said that the publishing industry moves at the speed of books.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it's funny, like comic books obviously moves faster than that. But, and I will say, like, once we finished the first four issues and went to Comixology with them, things did move very, very fast. I have no complaints. Any delay is purely my fault and Harvey's.
It's a huge shift to go from movie production and go back into comics. And comic books are still kind of the heart and soul of visual arts, and have been for a long time. The methodology is the same. You still tell your story visually, and you can't see into the characters' heads the way you can in a third person narrative. Third person omniscient narrative. So your approach to storytelling is still very much the same as it is for motion pictures or television.
It's funny. I've actually been writing comic books long enough now that I've witnessed the change. Back when I started writing comics.
Oh, yes. I know what you're talking about.
Go ahead. Still third person and first person narration. And now you see, I wouldn't say it's completely gone, but you see much, much, much less of that in comic books these days. Comic books have become more, for lack of a better term, cinematic. So I've watched that transition happen over the course of two decades, and it's fascinating. It's like, we're actually just now starting to talk as an industry about, hey, we kind of changed the way we wrote comics over the last 20 years.
Yes, we have.
Yes, really we have.
I know exactly what you're talking about, because my associate editor wrote an editorial about this just last month.
Oh, wow.
About the death of the thought balloon.
Yes.
You don't see those anymore.
No,
you don't get
gone.
To see the internal dialogue of a character anymore. It's all show, don't tell.
Totally. Totally, which is show don't tell is of course the mantra of live action,
right?
In TV and film, so it's very interesting to see that mantra come into, come into comic books. I love narration. I love writing it, but I also love reading it. I'm not opposed to it by any means. I do like how less copy and more show don't tell has really sort of supercharged the art. I think that's been the real benefit of this trade-off that we've made, and I think we've kind of made it unintentionally. It really was certain, like, I've never gotten a note from an editor like, I don't want any narration in this book, and I want to say it was like Brian Vaughn with Why the Last Man back in the early aughts, that was the first time I can remember reading a book that didn't have any narration in it. And that was like a real game changer for me just to see that. It never in a million years would have occurred to me that the entire industry would largely follow Brian's example.
We were talking about how the narrative technique has changed over the last 20 years. Do you think it's got to do with the feedback loop of comic books going to motion pictures?
Well, that's it. All the comic book writers grew up watching comic book movies.
I definitely think there's a bit of that. I definitely think there's a bit of that. Like, it's interesting because when I write, I've been writing for the last 5 years various Star Wars comics. And when I write Star Wars in comic book form, I basically hold myself to the limitation of the same narrative devices and tools that they have for the movies. Mm-hmm. So, for example, when Chewbacca or a Wookiee speaks, there are no subtitles. You know, we never know what Chewbacca is saying.
Right, right. You get it by context.
I don't care what
you smell. Get in there.
Right. That's right. So, well, I'm not going to give myself the ability to translate that dialogue. Similarly, there is no narration in Star Wars apart from the opening crawl. So mm-hmm. I don't do any narration in my Star Wars books. So I think there's something, it's a long way of saying, I think there's something to your theory, Susan, that, you know, you've got all these, you know, comic book writers who now are, in the very least, are thinking in terms of telling superhero stories through the lens, not of comic books anymore, but through the lens of cinema. And that is creating a little bit of a feedback loop. I also think part of it is, you can see there's been a move over the last several decades for comic book writers to really cut back on the number of tools that they have at their disposal. Everyone is painting, myself included, with fewer colors on the palette. And what that's done is, like I said, it's opened up the art in a really big way. There's, you know, you have a lot less panels per page now than you did back in the 80s and 90s. You have a lot less copy on each individual page than you did back in the 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. So I think also just part of it is this evolution towards how can we reduce the panel to page ratio and reduce the amount of copy that's covering each page, so to really let the art shine.
And that's part of the evolution of the narrative.
Yeah.
It's in the earlier days, you relied a lot more on written exposition to convey the scene because you often didn't have that kind of detail in the panels themselves.
Well, and the reason for that is back, you know, certainly since Marvel came on the scene, artists, because of Stan Lee, artists started working what was called Marvel method, which was the writer would only give them a few pages of plot. Mm-hmm. So the panels couldn't really reflect exactly what was in the writer's head because the artist didn't know what to draw.
Right.
So then, of course, you'd have a writer come in afterwards and dialogue everything. And that's why you had 90% of the story really being told in the captions.
Very often, yeah, I remember that.
It's an interesting transition. I mean, I was just rummaging through my old stuff, and I found that giant-sized Spider-Man versus Superman.
Oh, yeah.
That was very interesting.
A classic.
Oh, yeah. I think I got four copies of that sucker.
Oh, that's amazing. That's worth something.
Yeah, well,
If it was in better shape,
I think it's worth maybe in the shape mine copies are in, I think they're worth about $20 a piece. But the simplicity of the panels, I mean, you have the characters and then you have the backgrounds, and the backgrounds are really just a few lines and some splotches of color. And that's really it. And then the rest of it is how iconic can we make these poses and tell the story in dialogue? And that's all you get.
Pretty much.
I'd have been more impressed if you'd said you'd dug up old pages of Zip-A-Tone to.
I used to use Zip-A-Tone.
I don't need to now.
Yeah, I remember Zip-A-Tone. I remember that.
Yeah, I used to use that stuff.
Of course you did.
Me too.
But nobody's using it now. It's just, you know, copy and paste.
Well, now it's all digital. Digital has also really, really changed the medium in a huge way.
No kidding. I was looking at the backgrounds and things in Ulysses and.
Yeah.
You know, you sure couldn't do that in the 70s.
Well, I will tell you, actually, I mean, I don't know, I wouldn't say you could or you couldn't. What I will say is that Harvey does not work digitally. He's all pen and ink on paper.
Okay, I said corrected.
So
glorious. Yeah. That's glorious.
Then that kind of brings
everything,
us back
everything
to...
Everything you see is hand-drawn. It's not... He's not even using digital models for the ships and transferring them to the paper. He's drawing
on cards.
Yes.
Oh, wow. Yes. See, and this
brings us back to Metal Hurlant, to heavy metal.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's that, you know, back in the day, that was the only book around here that
yeah, 19, yeah, circa 1975, issue number one, yeah, in 1975.
God, we bought Metal that. Whatever happened to that? Do you still? Yeah, I don't have mine.
I think I still have mine. I still have my copy of it. But that was the other thing I wanted to touch on. This is being released electronically only?
So basically, for now, I wouldn't say only. I would say it's first being released digitally. So basically, what Comixology has is an arrangement with several different publishers. Mm-hmm. And those publishers are then free once the book has already been released digitally. Then the publishers are free to, if they want, publish the book, you know, the old-fashioned way. Because we're still early on in the run, we've only released the first issue, we haven't had those conversations with other publishers. Mm-hmm. My hope is that at some point it does get released, you know, on paper, as it were. It's funny, I love...
$6 or $7 a book.
Well, that's the thing. They're not, you know, physical books obviously are not cheap. There's pros and cons, right? The funny thing is, I read all the comic books I read on my iPad. Mm-hmm. I read through Comixology. I find the reading experience to be superior when it's digital. At the same time, comic books is not just a medium of consumption, it's a medium of collection. So
you want to own it, you want to collect it.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, my hope is that at some point we'll publish it in actual paper, you know, bound, you know, trade paperback. So we'll see. Keep your fingers crossed.
So that's a curious inversion. I would have thought it would have been paper first, then Comixology, you know, or digital distribution as an aftermarket.
Yeah, but paper distribution is very troubled right now. The collapse of being able to send them overseas to get printed.
Alliance Entertainment trying to buy Diamond, and then having the whole deal fall through, and then Diamond having lied about contracts that they had with Wizards of the Coast that they didn't have, and oh my freaking God! No, you sure can't.
You know,
and the terrible thing is the whole industry is like pivoting on this, and nobody knows what the hell's going on.
In the meantime, I think their loss is Comixology's gain.
Oh, well, probably. I mean, certainly it definitely, I think, helps Comixology. I think, you know, for the traditional publishers, it couldn't come at a worse time. You know, and it's like, what, the comic book industry didn't have enough problems and enough challenges? It's unfortunate. I really do hope it gets sorted out sooner rather than later, just because, you know, I think, look, Comixology is going to be fine. I don't think Comixology needs, you know.
Yeah, I think they're going to be fine. I think the future of comic books in a printed, physical form is going to fall to the independents.
It could. That could very well happen. I think Marvel and DC are still very committed to print. You know, certainly in trade paperback form. And there's always the rumor, like, oh, are they going to change the monthly, what we call floppies, to digital? But again, I don't see that happening, you know, in the near term, at least. I know a lot of people at Marvel and DC, and they're both, you know, all those people, both companies are really committed to, you know, to print. And one of the reasons they're committed to print is they're committed to the brick and mortar retail stores that, you know, can only sell prints.
Right.
You know, that's a very important symbiotic relationship to them. So, you know, I don't believe they'll do anything to hurt their retail partners.
So, Ulysses Monarch is the first run is 5 books.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and how far ahead have you charted this out?
Well, I've got notes I've got notes in my notebook that are probably, I would say, the equivalent of about 2 years worth of story, you know, released on a monthly basis. I haven't, like, broken those notes down into, okay, this goes into this issue, this goes into that issue. It's more in terms of, like, character arcs and sort of where the series goes. And also, like, sort of how it's organized. You know, I'm organizing this book in five-issue arcs, the idea being that each arc should almost feel like its own movie, you know, with the beginning, middle, and end. Like, we you know, I don't want to spoil the end, obviously, of the first arc, but we end with what I hope is an ending that is both definitive but also leaves you wondering about where things could go next.
So every five issues, you get a trade paperback out of it.
Exactly. Which is the, you know, that's the way I do my monthly Marvel comics, for example.
Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of them that way.
And it's
satisfying. You don't have to wait a month. You can just read the whole dang story.
Yeah. And by the way, I think, like, there are some books that really lend themselves to that. You know, there's some books where people say, like, just the way the story is paced out monthly doesn't really work for me. I need to, like, you know, wait for the trade paperback to come out and read it all, or read five issues or six issues all in one sitting, which I respect that, too. It's, you know, look, at the end of the day, I just want people reading comic books. Whether they're reading it digitally, in print, you know, monthly, by trade paperback, I'm just thrilled that they're reading. And our biggest challenge, I think, in the comic book industry is, how do we get our product out to as many different kinds of people as possible? And I think that starts with, well, first of all, by making the product available in a variety of different ways.
Yeah, all the outlets you can do, like do them all at once if you can. And yeah, of course, that's hideously expensive as well. But I note that the tendency to wait for the trade paperback is kind of the same as binging shows on Netflix.
I was just about to say.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. It's
fine. It's a change in the way we consume our entertainment.
I'm doing a Star Wars comic book now called Jedi Knights, where each issue is a self-contained story. So there's no need to wait for the trade. You could if you want to, but each month you are getting a story with a beginning, middle, and end, very much like it was back in the old days. It's an interesting challenge, I have to say, from a writing perspective. I feel like I'm offering the readers just a different way of consuming their comics than what they've become used to.
So writing for comic books, is how would you compare that to, say, writing a screenplay for a superhero movie? Because I know you've done one.
Yeah. I have the critically acclaimed Academy Award nominated Green Lantern movie.
That's the one.
I didn't hate it. I actually liked that movie.
I'm sorry, I did.
I wasn't being a purist about what character arcs were going on, and taken as itself, it was fine. There's nothing wrong with it.
Thank you. The thing I always say about Green Lantern is a very simple Google search will surface our first draft. Which is very much a first draft, but we'll show you the movie we intended to make before other third parties got involved.
I'm going to go do that when we're done, because that's going to be an eye opener.
Okay. Yeah, I think it will be. I really think it will be. It's funny. I think at this point, I've been writing screenplays and comic books for so long. I wouldn't say that there's no difference. The difference, though, I don't approach the project creatively any differently than if it's comic book versus film versus television. The creative approach pretty much remains the same. Figuring out what the character arcs are, figuring out how to, twist and turn the plot, figuring out the set pieces. But the difference for me really is it's a practical one. It's, I sort of liken writing... comic books feels a little bit like filling in a crossword puzzle to me. There's a little bit of math involved with it, because I have a certain amount of pages and I have a certain amount of panels per page, and I want to, like, structure it so that key reveal happens on a page turn and not in the middle of the page. Similarly, I try to, like, not change scenes in the middle of the page, not change locations. So, like, there's a little bit of math in terms of, like, how does the story lay out into this medium in a way that leans into the strengths of the medium. So it's, for me, it's a more of a procedural difference than it is a creative difference.
As contrasted to the work that you did on the Percy Jackson movie, what was it? You did the second one.
The Sea of Monsters?
Yes, I did Sea of Monsters. Well, Sea of Monsters was an interesting challenge insofar as I only had 3 weeks to write the movie.
Wow.
What happened was it's a little bit of a long story, but basically they were like, we have 3 weeks. What can you give us in 3 weeks? And this was a rewrite. They were like, what can you change in 3 weeks? And I said, look, I'll be honest. There's like certain things that I think I absolutely have to change. And then there's other sort of more luxury items that I would like to change. But I said, honestly, look, in my assessment, you really do need a brand new script. And if I can somehow write that in 3 weeks, that's what I would like to deliver, because that's what the project wants. You know, the project needs, mm-hmm. you know, not a couple of nips and tucks on the existing draft, but rather it really needs a wholesale, you know, what we call a page one rewrite. So I just sat down and, you know, hunkered down, and 3 weeks later, I had a script.
Here's a fun fact. You and I both worked on that movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really?
I was working at Rhythm and Hughes in the training department, teaching animators and effects people how to use the pipeline and the production tools while that show was running. And I think I even had screen credit.
That's amazing. I thought Rhythm and Hughes did an absolutely terrific job. It's Percy Jackson's Sea of Monsters. And we were doing the movie at a time when, you know, fluid dynamics to animate water, very, very, very challenging.
Yes.
Rhythm and Hughes was coming off of Life of Pi, mm-hmm. and, you know, really, like, just a really fantastic company at the height of their powers. We got them at a very, I think, opportune moment.
Yeah, I think Life of Pi actually came after that.
They were working on Life of Pi contemporaneous.
That's right. They were.
But there was Sea and there was Monsters. If you call a tiger a monster, I don't know. It is.
Well,
when
they had plenty of water to deal with.
Lots of water. Nobody believed that there was no real tiger.
Yeah, it's just incredible, right? And absolutely, no. That was, you know, that company was doing really cutting edge work at the time. Really cutting edge work.
Yeah, it's a shame the way the whole thing turned out. But the point I was going for was how different it is to try to adapt somebody else's work and cut it into pieces and try to plug it all together into a cohesive whole and smooth over the seams in 3 weeks. That's pretty incredible stuff.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate it. I'm sure there are people who said I didn't do a particularly good job of it. But, you know, my attitude when it comes to adaptations is, both as a writer and quite frankly as a fan, I'm not necessarily interested in a, you know, perfect adaptation of something. Mm-hmm. You know, I know that there's a lot of fans who really sort of insist upon that. Percy Jackson fans, mm-hmm. especially.
Rick Riordan in himself was kind of stubborn about Rick that.
Please talk to Tolkien fans sometime.
Yeah,
exactly. So, but I've never been that way, again, just as a fan. And I really approach my writing still as a fan. But when I adapt something, I'm always about, how do I adhere not to the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law?
Like, the spirit is the whole thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
My perfect adaptation, you know, my opinion on what movie is the perfect adaptation of the book is The Princess Bride, and that's because the screenwriter was also the book author.
Right. Yes.
That made all the difference.
But it's a difference in the medium. You know, you can't. Yeah. You have 110 pages tops. Double space to tell the whole story in a screenplay.
And he could do that because he knew where the beats were and what was important.
Well, yeah.
And, you know, frankly, cutting the footnotes just made it work.
Yeah, a good example of a unbelievably faithful adaptation is Zack Snyder's Watchmen. Panel to frame. But I would argue that the best parts of the movie are where he actually deviated from the graphic novel, in the opening credits and in the ending. And again, it's like they're different mediums. They do different things well. They don't do all things well. You've got to lean into the strengths and lean away from the weaknesses. And unfortunately, like, that means changing some things. you know, sometimes those changes sit well with people and other times they don't. And I think sometimes it depends on the fans, you know, what their expectations are. But I will say no one ever sets out to make a bad movie. No one ever says, yeah, I'm going to destroy someone's childhood. You know, the intention is always to be positive. Unfortunately, not always successful.
I'm not sure I agree with that statement. I think there are some movies being made right now based on Winnie the Pooh and Snow White and Mickey Mouse.
I guess that's
true. Intentionally trash the...
Yes, I guess that's true. Yes,
But you know what? But I didn't ruin my childhood. The cartoons are still there to watch if you want to. You know, Star Wars was, you know, the first movie is still there. Nobody ruined my childhood with the ninth movie.
And E.E. Comics is still Winnie the Pooh.
Damn straight.
Yes. Let's see, the first one's out.
First one's out.
And
the second one comes out May 27th.
Yes. Thank you.
Because I looked. I was reading.
So it's been a real thrill having you on the show.
It's been a genuine pleasure for me.
Yeah, you have done so much for our genre.
Thank you.
And in particular. And it's just been a thrill to meet you, even virtually. So that I can say thank you for all the amazing work that you've done over the years.
I really appreciate that. Thank you very much. It's so great talking to you guys. It's delightful.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have been talking to Mark Guggenheim, a producer and writer and director and the creator of a new comic book series called Ulysses Monarch, The Adventures of Ulysses Monarch. The first edition is available on Amazon and Comixology right now, electronically. And there's going to be 5 issues, and it is a cut above. This is heavy metal grade stuff. And thank you so much for being on the show with us.
Well, thank you very much. I really had a great time.
This has been episode 284 of Action of the Event Horizon for May 17th, 2025. Our guest this evening has been writer and producer Mark Guggenheim.
This episode will air again at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern tomorrow afternoon, and 2 more times on the following Thursday and Saturday mornings at 4 a.m. Pacific, 7 a.m. Eastern. Once all of the airtimes have passed, you will find this episode as a podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Pandora, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and on our own website at sci-fi.radio. Sci-fi.radio is listener-supported sci-fi geek culture radio, and the vast majority of our funding comes from listeners just like you. If you enjoyed programming like what you just heard, we ask you to please visit patreon.com/sci-fi radio and pledge $5 or $10 a month to help keep the station on the air. That's patreon.com/sci-fi radio. The Event Horizon title sequence was written and produced by Gene Turnbow. The science officer was played by science fiction illustrator Mark Schirmeister. The engineer was Christian B. McGuire. The navigator was Christine Cherry. And the captain was voiced by science fiction grandmaster Larry Niven. This program is copyright 2025 by Krypton Media Group Incorporated. The Event Horizon on sci-fi.radio. It's sci-fi for your Wi-Fi.